This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian. Here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. This is the podcast that's designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks so much for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of November 17th, 2025. Maricopa County could be at risk of losing nearly 1,400 housing units for disabled, formerly homeless people. The Trump administration has announced a dramatic shift in federal funding opportunities for homeless service providers. Catherine Davis-Young has more.
The Department of Housing and Urban Development's next round of grants slashes funding for a category of homeless shelter known as permanent supportive housing. The administration says this type of program encourages dependence on government handouts. Tim Birch co-chairs the Maricopa Regional Continuum of Care. He says those units go to chronically homeless people who have disabilities.
Those are the populations we're most worried about because they're not highly likely to gain and maintain employment in order to be able to support themselves because of those disabilities.
Birch says regional partners are scrambling to tailor applications to fit the new requirements, but it's a major change. More than 80% of funding in Maricopa County goes to these permanent housing units now. HUD will cap that at just 30% in January. Catherine Davis-Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In science news, ancient Italy is making another appearance in Arizona. Back by popular demand after 8 years, Pompeii, the exhibition, has returned to the Arizona Science Center with remarkably well-preserved artifacts that are nearly 2,000 years old. Phil Latzman took a trip back in time.
It's August 24th, 79 AD. Things start off quietly in one of the Roman Empire's most prosperous cities. Off in the distance, however, the rumble of Mount Vesuvius. Just after midday, fragments of ash and pumice begin shooting out, plummeting the city. Soon, roofs cave in under 9 feet of debris. But the worst is yet to come. A pyroclastic flow, a deadly mixture of gas and volcanic matter, is heading down Vesuvius's slope. Unbeknownst to the Pompeians not already killed by the debris, it's about to incinerate the rest of them. By the time it's over, less than 24 hours later, the city with a population of at least 10,000 is teeming with bakeries, taverns, brothels, food shops, and laundries, is all entombed under 20 feet of volcanic matter. In this room at the Arizona Science Center, you literally feel the chill of the lifeless winds that blew over Pompeii that fateful day. Alex Bierson is the center's senior scientist for biology and environmental science.
I'm a geologist by training, so I get really excited about the volcano and the way that this incredibly tragic event allows us to have this time capsule into the past.
It wouldn't be till the 18th century that Pompeii and the nearby city of Herculaneum were unearthed with ancient artifacts, including weapons and armor and statues and cooking pots, all frozen in time. About 150 of them are on display here till April, as the roving exhibit returns to Phoenix for the first time since 2017. Sari Custer is the Science Center's Chief of Science and Curiosity.
Archaeologists have this unique opportunity when they uncovered Pompeii in the 1700s to see exactly where things would have been in the homes, in businesses, what was in the pots are still preserved.
So you're getting a look at stuff that is almost perfectly preserved, whereas if it hadn't happened, which would have been better for the people of Pompeii and Herculaneum, but we would never have gotten the chance to see this stuff preserved as well as it is.
Yes, it was, the city was destroyed, but it was preserved. So when that superheated ash covered the city, it wasn't that they were used over time and destroyed.
In the like new artifacts, evidence of an advanced first century society.
I mean, it was a rich town. They were prosperous. It was a port town. So there was a lot of market and industry happening there. And you can see how advanced they were.
The most striking part of the exhibition, though, may be in the form of plaster.
When archaeologists were uncovering the city, they found these large spaces, these vacuous spaces, and they said, what are these big holes? And so one of the scientists said, well, let's fill it with plaster and see what the shape is. And when they pulled that piece of plaster out, it was in the shape of a human. And they did this over and over again with all of these spaces and ended up finding many people where the body had decomposed and left this space.
The dugout casts reveal crumpled bodies and shocked facial features still chillingly intact.
That is extremely emotional to see those last moments of those people's lives. That was devastating, but again, a really unique glimpse into something that happened 2,000 years ago.
The geologist Alex Bearson says volcanic activity is also a thing in Arizona, and even more recently.
Our most recent eruption here in Arizona was actually 1,000 years ago. The small volcano of Sunset Crater erupted up in the San Francisco lava field, and we have volcanism all over the state, up in Flagstaff, down south in the Chiricahua Mountains. So there's definitely a lot of parallel between the history we see at Pompeii and the geology we have here as well.
But they say another eruption here isn't anticipated, at least anytime soon.
Geologically, that's just yesterday. So the potential is there. Is it likely that we're going to have a volcanic eruption tomorrow? No. But the potential is there, and it did happen in the time that people were living here in Arizona 1,000 years ago.
The exhibition on loan from Italy is on display at the Arizona Science Center until April 12th. In Phoenix, Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. In today's fast-paced world, where misinformation spreads rapidly, KJZZ fills the gap with trusted factual reporting. You can help keep this perfect mix of local, national, and global news strong when you donate to fill the gap in funding. Make your financial gift at kjzz.org today, and thank you. In business news, Coconino County is purchasing a new mobile library to reach the farthest edges of what is one of the largest counties in the United States. Michelle Marisco reports from onboard the current Bookmobile, which is retiring from its service.
Just like its mainstay counterparts, the Flagstaff City Coconino County Library Bookmobile offers a bit of everything. A touch of mystery, the opportunity to try something new, but instead of the reader coming to the stacks, the library goes to the reader. And as a rolling library, it has its own unique problems, some involving Stephen King. More on that later.
I'm Becca Wilson. I'm the Coconino County Bookmobile Librarian.
I met Becca Wilson downtown Flagstaff where the massive bookmobile was garaged. She was wrapping up an inspection of the big, colorful bus before heading out for the day.
We are off to the Loop Chapter House on the Navajo Nation.
The 20-year-old bus creaks out of the garage and then down Route 66. Wills is a former journalist and off-grid farmer. In many ways, her life's path intertwines with the large squeaking bus rattling down Route 66, its metal shelves bouncing with every rhythmic crackle on the old road.
While I was looking for jobs, the position here in Flagstaff came open for the bookmobile librarian. And it was my dream job.
The 36-foot-long bus needed refurbishing. Wills needed a commercial driver's license to drive it.
And I had really missed, you know, working at reference desk, working with people day to day to help them find information.
The bookmobile has about 150,000 miles, and Wills adds to that on a weekly basis, crisscrossing America's second biggest county, stopping as far as the north rim of Grand Canyon National Park.
We go to Jacob Lake on the way. We go to stops along Marble Canyon and the Vermilion Cliffs. We go all over Navajo Nations.
The bus also stops at various Navajo chapter houses and is still adding schools to its route.
It's maybe a little like a travel school bus in terms of its ability, but it's largely just a large vehicle to do narrow dirt roads and sometimes muddy and other conditions.
Then a sudden crash behind us.
And that's the Stephen King shelves.
We rolled across eastern Flagstaff towards a painted desert and pull into a dirt lot across from the Loop Chapter House. Wayne Hobson climbed aboard to return a slew of movies and to browse through Wilson's personal recommendations for him.
I never went to school, but I know how to read. So a lot of these books help me out to understand people's lives and my life.
Today he's checking out Sun Tzu's Art of War.
That one's complex.
He's also reading a history book of enslaved Native Americans and
Cadillac Deserts. That one was a great one. That one really made me think, wow, we're all falling.
Gladys Riggs stopped in to refresh her reading collection at home. With Winslow 30 miles away and Flagstaff 45, this bookmobile stop once a month makes browsing easier. She's into John Grisham, Amy Tan, but also...
I try to tend to go back to the old ones, like Gone with the Wind.
Luke Chapter House Manager Vida J. Galloway considers a bookmobile a strong asset to the community. In the future, she hopes to offer a children's reading center and a computer literacy program at the Chapter House. But for now...
When we can get the bookmobile here, it's wonderful. We have they have patrons that go and see them. I know that this past season, there's been a couple of times where their bookmobile was not able to make it out here, and so we had to cancel on that day.
50 years ago, County Supervisor Patrice Horseman was a passenger on board the bookmobile.
And people came out. It was like a party. So families, their children, they all came out to join the bookmobile. It was a very joyous day. So it has always held a very, very important and place in my heart.
And so the current iteration of the big, squeaky bookmobile has served its mission.
In 2019, for example, that bookmobile put on 19,000 miles traveling around the county, made over 1,400 stops, and was really a much loved and important part of some of the most isolated parts of Coquitlam County. We needed to do something.
A 24-foot bookmobile with the same flavor of the old one will arrive in 2026. On board the bookmobile, outside of Loop, Arizona, I'm Michelle Marisco, KJZZ News.
In politics news, an Arizona water agency took a historic vote on Wednesday to pursue multiple water augmentation projects to boost the state's water supply, including desalination. From the politics desk, Cameron Sanchez reports.
The Water Infrastructure Finance Authority unanimously approved four augmentation project proposals on Wednesday. Nothing is official yet, but the public will now be able to participate in a long information gathering process. WIFA member Ted Cook called it a momentous step for the state.
We've been waiting for something like this to develop, and not for lack of trying, over a long period of time. And we can certainly have cause for celebration.
Desalination could benefit Arizona in some of a few ways. The state could develop a desalination facility in either California or Mexico and bring the water into Arizona, or could negotiate a deal to trade that water in exchange for some of California or Mexico's allocation of Colorado River water. Cameron Sanchez, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In Tribal Natural Resources, supported in part by a grant from the Katina Foundation. It's not every day you get to see an eagle, let alone two together, alive and up close. As Gabriel Piacerazio reports, it's something visitors of Liberty Wildlife recently did while blessing these animals.
Robert Mesto with Liberty Wildlife is Pasquayaki and honors eagles Cisco and Anasazi with a song.
And they're revered for their strength, their intelligence, and even their healing and protective powers.
Things the Phoenix nonprofit is helping guests tap into. One November Sunday morning.
Pinch some sacred tobacco, take it to the eagle, and say their prayer. And oftentimes the eagles will flap their wings. To feel the wind of the eagle is like the ultimate experience.
That lasted for an hour. Augie Molina, who is Pasquayaki, spiritually prepared people bringing offerings to the birds by burning sage bundles and tapping them with a fan made from feathers, while those being cleansed bathed in the smoke.
When you smudge, it's going to take as long as it's going to take.
Gabriel Piacerazio, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In education news. A Tolleson school board voted Tuesday against building a widely criticized $80 million domed football stadium. Cameron Sanchez reports.
Tolleson Union High School District Superintendent Jeremy Caez is a strong proponent of building the first domed high school stadium in Maricopa County as part of a planned new school facility. He argues it's necessary to protect students from the Arizona heat and would be a valuable space.
It's hot, and it's even hotter on turf. Keeping our students in an air-conditioned environment, yes, to me, is much safer for them than having them play outside.
But the proposal drew criticism from community members and lawmakers who felt the stadium would cost far too much taxpayer money. The board voted unanimously to build a less expensive, uncovered stadium. Cameron Sanchez, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, from KJZZ's The Show, it's time for our TV playlist after a decade of streaming technology. Here's co-host Sam Dingman.
We are now almost a decade removed from the period many critics referred to as the peak TV era. Back in the mid to late 2010s, streaming services helped create a rush of boundary-pushing shows. But the medium that was once referred to as the small screen is now just another screen. And TV's creative and economic environments have shifted. Those same streaming services now double as media companies. And while we often hear that they're struggling financially, there's also more new shows to watch than ever before. To make sense of all this, I recently spoke to Peter Murrieta, a professor of practice at ASU's Sidney Poitier New American Film School, who's also a TV writer and producer. He told me he thinks TV has entered a new era.
I would say we're in the playlist era of TV.
Ooh, interesting.
As opposed to the previous era of appointment viewing. I think when you look at how people watch and you go online, you'll see a lot of people announcing they're doing a rewatch of something that they loved for comfort, or you're seeing small selections of things that are being tossed around in social media, which drive people to the original thing. And so in some ways, it reminds me of how exciting it was when Spotify began and you realized I could listen to almost anything in the history of music, as opposed to when I was younger, where you would have to seek these things out.
Interesting. So it's almost like the ethos that now dictates music, where the idea is everything is available and you curate it yourself based on, you know, the whims of social media and the algorithm, rather than a major studio kind of making a bold statement about where they think people's tastes are headed. Or
yeah, that's right. That's right. And I think the studios still feel and have power in that marketing way, in the distribution way. We're living in this time, the in-between place. Like, I absolutely agree with you. But at the same time, I would say, for the proof of what I'm talking about, you can just see that Tim Robinson's The Chair Company is out, and you go online and you can see quick clips from it on TikTok, on Instagram, in Reels. And these are the moments that people are talking about, which are driving people to the show. And sure, the studio's probably got a hand in some of it, but it's also the fans themselves and the culture that are driving it.
It also seems to me, and please tell me if this is off base, like there's been this interesting discourse recently of Gen Z folks, say, discovering shows like Girls or Sex and the City or The Wire for the first time, watching them in the middle 2020s without the social and cultural context happening around them that existed when those shows were first released, and prompting this reconsideration of them that sometimes is flattering and sometimes is perhaps not so flattering.
Sure.
Is that something you've observed?
Absolutely. I think let's talk about a show, not one of the ones you listed. Let's talk about Suits. Great example of something that was from the USA Network and ran many seasons, and then found this incredible online audience, you know, coming just out of the pandemic, and to such a degree that the show rocketed to the top of the charts on Netflix, where it now lives, and created a desire for a brand new Suits to be made, which only lasted one season, right? And it was canceled.
Right.
And so you look at that and you're like, well, what is that about? Well, I think that's about the people who found Suits. What did they really love about it? I think what they loved is it was very comforting. That show had each episode had a beginning, middle, and end. And it also had a lot of episodes. And that capture gave that generation something they could chew on for a while.
It almost seems like, from what you're saying, that what they're reacting to may not even be, and I know this is not unique to Gen Z, but what they're reacting to with Suits is as much the story of the show as the feeling of comfort that comes from discovering a new world that you can really kind of sink into.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the same emotional feeling you get that I got when I was a teen and my uncle would hand me a record album and say, this is the Rolling Stones. I think you're going to want to know about this. Right. And then I'm in the 80s discovering, you know, rock from the 60s by way of someone else handing it to me. And right. And that's the online equivalent of the computer algorithm in one hand. But I would also say it's the communities that grow up around the fandoms that grow up around shows. Like, I'm very excited to see this new Buffy series that's coming. And just read this morning about, you know, the original cast, Buffy's, you know, Sarah Michelle Gellar's in it. The creator of the new Buffy talked about how it's very much a sequel. It's not a reboot. It's not a reimagine. And that feels like someone who understands a contemporary audience and how to engage them.
That's interesting to me because I can remember about 10 years ago at this point, a similar boomlet of attempts like this to recapture lost glory. Mm-hmm. There was the reboot of Gilmore Girls. There was the reboot of The X-Files.
Reboot of Sex and the City.
Exactly. And the sense I have is that most of those reboots didn't fare so well. Do you think there's a sense in the industry that they've figured out how to do it right this time?
Well, you always hope so. I think the tension between them, you know, is economic and creative, and the streaming wars are over, and, you know, Netflix won. Mm-hmm. And now the folks that went up against them are having to figure out how to become profitable and what is their streaming service doing. So I think that's always going to be the thing. But I would say in terms of being a TV advocate, and where I've centered most of my career, not all of it, TV is still the one place, in spite of all that you just said and I just said, where an original idea can win the day. I think when an original film does well, there's lots of ink spilled about it. When Sinners does well, there's stories. Oh my gosh, an original movie. Right. But with TV, I love that, you know, there'll always be room for The Bear and The Chair Company. I think TV is still that place where success can come with something brand new. They're building more sound stages in Hollywood. At the same time, they're telling us, you know, they're not making as much.
Right.
So that begs a question.
Yeah.
And then my follow-up to my own question is, you know, there was a announcement that I believe Netflix made not too long ago where they said after possibly a quarterly earnings call that they see only YouTube as their competition. And I was very excited to see YouTube's sort of response to it, which was YouTube pays its creators better than Netflix. So you're like, oh, wow, okay. So they're speaking about the creator economy. They're not speaking about the legacy business. And yet, if you find a way to push through on YouTube and find an audience, it's a very exciting time if you've got an idea, I think.
Well, I've been speaking with Peter Murrieta, who is the deputy director of ASU's Sidney Poitier New American Film School. He's a professor of practice there and also a TV producer and writer in his own right. Peter, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation and Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation and Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian. This is KJZZ. Listen more, learn more, online and on the KJZZ mobile app.